Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, the people have spoken, both around the country and here in Oklahoma. Today, we recap the state of Oklahoma politics the day after Republican State Chairman Pam Pollard called this election day a historic day. And as one observer said, it may seem hard to believe, but Oklahoma actually got a little redder on Tuesday. And the numbers bear that out. 3 seats gained by the GOP in the state Senate, now at 42 Republicans and only 6 Democrats in the upper house. A pickup of 4 to 5 state House seats. That gives the GOP a supermajority of over 75% in both houses of the legislature. But interestingly, when it came to state questions, Oklahoma picked an independent path with a few surprises. Joining me to recap the state vote and its likely effect on decisions made in Oklahoma City in the coming year is David Blatt, the executive director of the nonpartisan but progressive-leaning Oklahoma Policy Institute, to join us to talk about the election results here in the state of Oklahoma. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
As we look at a recap of yesterday's election, at least at the state level, certainly, there were no surprises in the federal offices here in the state. No surprise that Donald Trump carried the state handily and that our congressional and Senate delegation will go back to Washington intact with large pluralities. Were there any surprises at the state level in your mind at last night's election?
I think overall, it was not a surprise that the Republicans kept their large majorities in the legislature. I think there were probably 2 surprises. One was the magnitude of Republican victories in the legislative races. It was another very bad night for state Democrats in Oklahoma. For example, on the Senate side, there were 18 contested races last night. Republicans won all 18. So when the legislature convenes in February, there'll be 42 Republicans, 6 Democrats, and those are all seats that weren't up in this cycle. On the House side, the Democrats were able to win some seats, win some open seats, but it was still a net gain of, I believe, 5 seats for Republicans, putting them out around 75 or 76 seats out of 101. So I think Democrats had some hope of maybe gaining a seat or limiting the Republicans' wins, and that didn't happen. So that was one surprise to some. The other was on the state questions, where I think that voters showed a lot more independence, looked at them a little differently than they did where it came down to voting on candidates.
Now, what do you suppose the legislatures take as they go back to Oklahoma City for the next session? What do you suppose they're thinking that voters told them as they go back for the next session?
You know, that's a good question, because there was really not a very strong Republican message at the state level in this campaign. They were, to a certain extent, on the defensive about budget cuts, on the defensive about the crisis in education funding. Most of them opposed the penny sales tax initiative and promised to do something different. I imagine we'll talk about that over the course of our discussion. But I'm not sure that Republican legislators are going to be able to claim that it was a clear mandate for something specific. I think what they will say is that this has become a very Republican state, more so last night than ever in our history, and the trend both on the registration side and on voting is definitely in Republicans' favor. But now that we have this supermajority Republican legislature, it's a supermajority to do what? And I don't know that they will have a clear answer to that. I think that they will have to take seriously what many of them said about the need to do something about education. There'll be more to do on criminal justice. And they're going to inherit a big budget mess. So it's going to be a challenge.
Is there any sense that maybe they'll go back to Oklahoma City saying, this is a validation for our approach to our current budget woes, what we did last session?
That's possible, except I'm not sure what approach they're going to claim credit for. Last session, where we had this budget hole of more than $1 billion, and it was patched together through a combination of deeper cuts to higher ed and mental health and public safety, which I didn't hear many candidates bragging about or claiming they want to do more of. And then it was mostly pieced together through one-time revenue. Nobody was happy with last year's budget, not the majority party, not the minority party. I think everybody agreed that we can't continue this way without more structural solutions to the budget problem. But there was also no consensus on what that solution will look like.
Now, one of the secrets that was approaching as Election Day came near was, how are we set for this budget year? Because there's a lot of whispers. There's no one who will confirm it on the record at this point, but I've heard as early as sometime this month, we may have a revenue failure for this year's budget.
There's a couple of things. You're always looking at how revenues are doing for the current budget year, which began in July. We're now 3 or 4 months in, and then what it looks like for next year. So the first 2 months of this year were actually pretty good, and then September was a bad month. We have not yet received October numbers. So there is a chance that we could at some point face a situation like last year where revenues are not coming in on pace with the estimates and we need to implement mid-year cuts. That certainly isn't clear yet, may or may not happen. But then as we look to next year, the fact that this year's budget was balanced with anywhere from $500 to $700 million, depending on how you count it, means that even if we do see some encouraging economic signs and revenues, tax collections start to grow again, we're still going to have this big hole just to supplant all the one-time money that was
that in $500 to $700 million was one-time money.
One-time
correct.
Money, yeah. Through bond issues, through moving the money around from different agency funds, taking money from roads and bridges and other funds just to get things to balance.
Yeah. You said, you know, we're looking at not sure if we're going to have a revenue failure yet, but you're also looking at agencies in the state that, well, let's just put it frankly, higher education in Oklahoma, it was assumed that the sales tax for education was going to pass in passing their budget because, what did they take, a 16-18% cut?
They took around a 15% cut this year, and that was on top of deep cuts last year. So we were talking about it as higher ed took a preemptive cut, assuming, as you said, that State Question 779 was likely to pass and that was going to bring an additional $130 million or so to higher ed. So higher ed has already taken the cut. And I think it's fair to say that they will continue to have a big target on their back as we move ahead.
Has higher ed already taken that into account as far as their current year's budget, or were they planning on this injection of funds sometime toward the end of the year when this tax kicked in?
I don't know that they were all that optimistic, and I know that certainly among the higher ed officials who I've spoken with, they are very concerned. But certainly it's not just higher ed. We have the crisis in common education, and I think many people expected 779 to pass and to provide money for teacher salary increases, perhaps some money to hire new teachers and to put money into various education initiatives in the classroom. I think until a couple weeks ago, the assumption was that was going to pass. Part of the argument against 779 was that the legislature needs to assume its responsibilities.
Now, how much do you think the failure of 779 was exactly that? That voters were saying a message, this is the most regressive form of funding education. We shouldn't increase sales tax. We should increase other revenues within the normal legislative appropriation process to fund education properly. Or do you think it was just anti-tax?
I think there were a mix of several things. So I think one was some people felt like the legislature hasn't done its job and we are not going to let the legislature off the hook. They created the problem. They need to fix it. So some people felt outraged at the mechanism. And then there was certainly some genuine concern about the sales tax increase, particularly when you look at the $1 billion, $1.5 billion in cuts to the income tax, which have largely benefited wealthier people, to say that now we're going to shift more of our taxes onto low and moderate income families who pay more in sales tax. That was certainly a concern from people both on the left and on the right. And then, quite frankly, the argument that education has enough money already and it's just not being spent well, and there's too much money spent on administration, and we can't really trust the language for the money to be well. There's, you know, a certain skepticism about the education system, and in an election where I think a lot of voters went to the polls feeling angry and skeptical and wanting to send a message to all the elites, which I think played out in voting for president, voting for and voting for a number of the state questions, I think that education suffered. Did voters trust that this money was going to be well spent? Many of them didn't.
Now, let's take that to another side of it, which goes back to the legislature. You had this education caucus. About 25 teachers filed for the legislative positions in the Senate and in the House. I think out of 25, five were elected, and of those, three were Republican, two were Democratic. So really, this was not a referendum at all on education either.
No, we saw real...
You saw some races. I'll just mention the one candidate that failed, which was Waldron here in Tulsa, which is a Republican district, no doubt about it, and it was a very close race.
It was, and most people would say that John Waldron ran a terrific race.
As good a campaign as a state legislator could run. Yeah,
so I think we saw the influence of the Education Caucus, education advocates, in the filing period in April. A lot of people putting themselves out there, getting on the ballot. We saw a little bit of influence in June during the primaries, in who got out of the primaries. By yesterday, by November, that had really faded, and voters went to the polls and voted party. And, you know, they voted overwhelmingly for Trump for president, and they voted for Republicans for the legislature. I haven't been able to see the numbers yet on straight party voting, but that's an option in Oklahoma. And I think we're going to find out that Republicans racked up a huge advantage in people who chose the straight party line Republican over Democrat. And that advantage trumped, pardon the pun, trumped local circumstances with people who might have felt that John Waldron or Lloyd Snow or other local Democrats were good candidates. They voted for Republicans for the legislature. Then when it got time to the state question ballot, they voted much more independently and sort of all over the map.
Yeah. David Blatt, my guest is today, is executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. We recap the state election questions and races. What does this say about the Democratic Party at this point in Oklahoma? I mean, totally blanked on the state Senate. And my thought is, if the whole Senate had been up, I mean, there maybe one or two might have won in the Senate if all the seats had been up for grabs.
The problem for the state Democratic Party is that Democrats in Oklahoma are tied to the National Democratic Party, which is, frankly, very unpopular here. Unpopular with Obama at the head of the ticket, and equally, maybe a little more unpopular with Hillary Clinton at the top of the ticket. There was a time where Oklahomans were registered as Democrats, might have voted for a Republican president, but still were voting for Democrats locally. That's no longer the case. Registration is changing. So when people check off that straight party line, that is benefiting Republicans. So, you know, I think Democrats have done a good job of recruiting good candidates, supporting them as best they can with minimal resources. But they're definitely in a downward spiral where without an infusion of new legislators and mayors and local officials, it's hard to develop the candidates who run for statewide office. So I don't know how the party gets out of its tailspin, but we're still not even sure that, you know, that the Democratic Party has hit rock bottom. Some people thought that they had reached that 2 or 4 years ago, and yet they this time have fallen further. But it's going to have to be part of a national rebranding.
Well, and of course, Oklahoma has been a one-party state for most of its history. I mean, we've had competitive races over, say, from about the late 60s through the 80s, and then it's increasingly become another one-party state. And in the early part of the state's history, there were rock rib Republicans that were Republicans, but there were a lot of people who sided with the Republican Party that probably voted Democrat because or registered Democratic because they felt like they would have a voice in at least choosing the candidates that were likely to win the general election. Do we face that situation in Oklahoma today?
I think there's some of that. I think there's some people who are registering as Republicans just to have more of a say in contested primaries. But I think when you look at yesterday's result, we're not seeing sign of those Republicans in registration only going back to support Democrats. In fact, we're seeing people voting Republican up and down the ticket.
One of the things you mentioned to me before we start was you were looking at the diversity of the Capitol. The next incoming class of the legislature is likely to be what? Far less women?
Well, Oklahoma already ranked near the very bottom in the number or percentage of female legislators. I think we were third from the bottom. We had a good number of female legislators who term limited out, both Republican and Democratic women. So haven't put all the numbers together, but on the Senate side, for example, I mentioned that all 17 seats that were decided last night, all Republicans, only one of the 17 were women. So there will be the 42-member Republican caucus, I believe there will be three women going forward, and there will be two or three female Democrats. On the House side, my initial estimate is that there's going to be 13 women out of 101, maybe one or two more or less. So it's going to be a overwhelmingly male legislature again. It's going to be continue to be an overwhelmingly white legislature. There may be one or two candidates of Hispanic origin, but it's going to look a lot like the legislature looked 20, 30 years ago.
Well, let's take a look at the state questions. The state questions, as you mentioned earlier, this was a time where straight party voting, or even though these are nonpartisan questions, there's sort of a conservative and a progressive side or liberal side, if you will, to a number of these. And it looked like voters were not sending a clear message, except this is the only takeaway I've taken away from it, is that they really want to tackle their legislators to tackle problems based on their voting on the state questions and not sideshows.
Sure.
Because if you look at the first state question, the capital punishment one, it passed 64-65%. If you gave you that one and you looked at the rest of the state questions, you would say, well, the 780 and 781, the criminal justice reforms, they're going to go down in flames. Probably 790, the loosening of the Blaine Amendment on religious matters is going to pass easily. 792, alcohol is probably going to fail. But that was not the case. There was real picking and choosing among these questions of what passed and what failed.
Absolutely. Before yesterday, there had been a long streak of everything that had been put on the ballot over the last at least 12 years from the legislature, almost regardless, was passed. And that history would have suggested that 777, the Right to Farm Amendment, and 790, the language to allow for the Ten Commandments monument to be put back on the Capitol and to do away with the restriction on using public dollars for religious purposes, those should have sailed through. They had big support behind them, and they sounded like good conservative red meat, right to farm, more religion. They failed quite convincingly. At the same time, as you said, criminal justice reform measures, which really were some pretty bold steps in making all drug possession charges as misdemeanors rather than felonies, and taking whatever savings can be calculated and putting that into treatment. So we're saying that we really need to provide treatment and not punishment for people with drug addiction, substance abuse issues. That won despite some very strong opposition from the district attorneys. So on those issues, you know, there were broad coalitions, but the clear-cut conservative positions went down on at least three of the state questions. And then you had alcohol modernization. You know, if Oklahoma is, as we like to think, such a traditional religious state, well, we've seen this now for decades, that Oklahomans do in fact support more access to alcohol. They've voted for gaming and alcohol repeatedly over the years. So it was, I think what happened with the state questions, people really gave this a lot of attention And you don't have straight party voting on the state questions. They really had to think it through. And I think they really did spend the time to think it through and came up with independent decisions.
And, you know, and what's also interesting is some of these state questions had a lot of money thrown into it. 779, the sales tax for education, had a lot of pro money. There was some opposition, but it wasn't really highly organized other than some signs and not much in the way of advertising against 779. Likewise, the only advertising I saw on 790, the religious question, was it was all about prayers at football games. And yet voters either saw through that or didn't believe the rhetoric.
I think that's right. There was certainly some late money that was spent in opposition to 779, the sales tax increase, and I think that was effective. I think that we did see probably a shift in public opinion over the last 10 days, 2 weeks of the campaign that corresponded with the ad campaigns, but may or may
but
not.
But the plurality suggested that probably didn't. I mean, it failed by so much.
It failed by
so
a
much,
large amount.
Yeah.
I mean, there seems to be one of the common refrains is that on most of these questions, there was an anti-establishment position, whether it was big agriculture or the church or education leaders or David Boren. Pretty much all those institutions that Oklahomans might have looked to for guidance on how to vote, they voted exactly the opposite. So it really, you know, it may have been some of the same populist anti-establishment messages that we saw in the Trump campaign and in Trump support here in the state and nationally may have been playing out in the state questions as well. But, you know, that's just speculation and, you know, morning after punditry as opposed to really having data that would tell us what was happening.
I'm going to send you one more question in that direction, which is, If this is sort of a new populist movement, is this a single election populist movement, or do you think this is a bigger trend in American politics?
Well, I want to answer that in two ways. I do think that the national results are going to really shake things up. You know, I think here in Oklahoma, we experienced two earthquakes this week, one on Sunday night and one on Tuesday night. I do think that we're going to see some major fault lines emerging in national politics, and that's going to play out on immigration, on trade, on economic issues. So, you know, I think that we'll see the consequences. The other is at the state level, I think part of the answer, part of the message or moral of this election is going to be that the ballot initiatives may be the way to go if you want to get things through. You know, the fact that although 779 failed, this criminal justice reforms passed may suggest that if you want such things as a minimum wage increase or an independent redistricting commission or other efforts, that the legislature may be a lost cause and you may want to just take it directly to the people who, you know, may have more wisdom when it comes to state questions than the legislature does.
All right. Well, David Blatt, we appreciate your looking back at the election, and thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
David Blatt is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, giving us a recap of yesterday's election here in the state of Oklahoma.
Thank you.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Jeff Martin.
My wife and I usually go out for dinner on Saturday night. She's a baker by trade and gets up ridiculously early, so we go out early as well. Usually the youngest couple in the room, no matter where we go. We have three or four regular spots we rotate through, but a few weeks ago, wanting to mix it up a little bit, I suggested we try something new. There's a place in town I'd always wanted to try, but for one reason or another, we never did. The place has mid-century roots and seems like something out of Mad Men. I threw the suggestion out there, not knowing if my wife would be game, but she was. We got a little more dressed up than our usual Saturday night attire, hopped in the car, and headed right over about 5:30 p.m. There were a few cars in the parking lot, a Cadillac, a Lincoln of some kind, pretty much what we expected. We walked in behind a couple of obvious regulars, talking already about what to order and what they had last week. The man was wearing shorts. The era of Don Draper was over. We walked in, grinning from ear to ear at the sheer lark of it all, the nostalgia, the novelty. We sat down in the mostly empty dining room, and within a minute or two, another couple entered slowly. A woman and a man, both appearing to be in their early to mid-80s. She moved a little quicker, helping him with his walker, moving at a glacial pace, up the one or two stairs, into his seat at the four-top table. Once she got him situated, she moved one or two times, trying to steer clear of the air conditioning vent. We are having a blast. The food is not bad, and the ambiance is living up to our campy expectations. I hear the waitress talking to the couple. Can I go ahead and get you something? No, we're waiting on our friends. It's our 60th wedding anniversary. The waitress showered them with a few congrats and left to attend other tables. With every few minutes that passed, I kept glancing over my shoulder, wondering when their friends might arrive. They sat quietly. Not much to say in the way of small talk after 60 years, I suppose. By the time we were finishing up our meals, the waitress returned to their table. How's it going over here? I guess we got stood up, the woman said. We'll go ahead and order. And they did. No one ever showed up. We left a short time later, full and satisfied with the whole experience. But I couldn't stop thinking about that couple. 60 years of marriage, and you have to dine alone? Maybe they were awful people. They looked nice enough. Who knows? Maybe their two friends were delayed by something serious and hadn't yet come around to the whole cell phone thing. More than anything else, I wished I was the kind of person who, in that moment, could have stood up, walked over to the table, and said, I overheard you say it's your 60th wedding anniversary. No one should dine alone on such a big occasion. Would it be okay if my wife and I joined you? I imagined that we'd sit there, not saying much, just soaking up all the stories they've told a million times. We'd laugh, they'd laugh, and the night would slowly become one of those random, unforeseen moments you never forget. It's so easy to be bold in retrospect.
Jeff Martin is a local writer, the founder of Booksmart Tulsa, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.